Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. Now, this is my first Willosophy that's happened backstage. I'm pretty excited about this. This next guest is somebody whose work I've been a fan of for a very long time, but we haven't really got to kind of meet and hang out, so this is going to be our first kind of bonding experience. So, guest, this is the question that I warned you I would ask, but here it is. Who are you?
I'm Bryony Kimmings. I'm a performance artist. That's what I call myself anyway. Although this week I'm teaching and I said I was a theatre maker.
That's interesting, isn't it? Do you think that a label's important when it comes to... Because performance artist, I think, says something, but what does it say?
I know, it's kind of difficult because I've always wanted to be faithful to the fact that I make performance art. So I make what I think is like art that happens in a performative or live way. But it also comes laden with the baggage of like people thinking that you're going to bleed all over them or do a poo and eat it. So like, you know, like it's, so yeah, I want to kind
you,
of keep...
Just for the record, have you ever done either of those things to an audience?
No.
Okay, good.
I had to think about that, didn't right, I? Yeah. I've probably done awful things.
I mean, there must have been a course at uni. You must have to do at least a week of pooing on the audience
or
something.
I must have done something like that.
Did my credits of bleeding on somebody.
Yeah, so I think I do actually. I'm not committed to. I just call myself whatever people kind of want to hear because I think I do. I'm a comedian, and sometimes I'll do bits that are just stand up, and then sometimes I make music. So I kind of just wear different hats, and I think that's actually probably the most enjoyable way to exist, as long as everyone doesn't get confused. You know, so I just change it depending on who I'm talking to.
Does that mean that audiences can find you hard to define, or do you like that?
That's kind of what I aspire to be like, I guess. But I don't want people to find that alienating or like in any way kind of sort of wanky or arty. Can I swear? Probably not. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, good.
It's a podcast.
Of course. And wanky's not really a swear word.
No. If you consider that swearing, then you are not the provocative performance artist that we thought you were.
No, that's true. Cunt. Yes.
There you go.
So I can't remember what the question was.
Oh, well,
who am I?
We'll get back to all this. Yeah. I wanted to know how you answered that question because it's always interesting to see what people say.
Yeah.
Now, this is a podcast where I ask people if they have a philosophy. Now, often those philosophies can be to do with love or life or family or day-to-day or, you know, often they tend to be about people's work. Yeah. Do you have, like, a philosophy behind your work or behind your life or something that you kind of, you know, aspire to and have a touchstone of?
I don't know because I never thought about it like a philosophy before because I'm probably scared of that word because I probably think it means something academic.
Right.
And I don't know what that means. Uh-huh. Do you know what I mean? Someone's going to talk about Nietzsche or something.
Right.
but I guess I probably am quite staunch in kind of how I do certain things and I think that probably comes from like ethical and kind of I guess philosophical standpoints. Some people would say I'm quite stuck in my ways.
Okay, well, that's but that's interesting in itself.
Yeah.
Now, what? Give me an example of what you mean by that.
So, I guess I love in a specific way, or expect to be loved in a specific way.
Is there we're not looking for
my love
details,
philosophy,
but
yeah.
What do you think it is? Like, what do you look for, you know, in somebody who's going to be a partner to you?
It's so changed, isn't it? It changes so much as you get older, I suppose. And like only very recently, my current partner, who hopefully will be my final dead partner, my fiancé,
Tim. Because you're killing him next week.
Because I'm going to kill him so I can get rid of him. I think that I've like it's one of those relationships where you suddenly come into your own or you kind of suddenly realize, oh, that's what love was. And I hadn't had one of those before. And I'm like 34. I think that was it's been kind of like really transformative for me. So I guess now I understand that, you know, relationships about talking and about, you know, clear communication about emotions and kind of real respect and kind of like, and kind of like being very loving, whereas I always thought they were about like being a wanker to each other and like fucking around. Do you know what I mean? So it's like really strange because it's only very recently that I've been shown love, and that teaches you how to love back.
Did you think when that happened that you was that something you were looking for, or did it take you by surprise?
No, it totally took me by surprise, and I thought I'd been in love, and then I realized, of course, I hadn't been in love. I'd been in lust, or I'd been in a very destructive sense of turmoil, you know, which I thought was love. I don't know. I didn't have parents that were together. So I think it sounds really cheesy and or a little bit like, I don't mean it in a kind of like sad way, but I don't think I saw heterosexual relationships that often. So I think, yeah, it took me by surprise in a glorious way. And I think for a while, I probably was a bit like, oh, I don't know what this is. And oh, this is quite difficult for me. And I've always been very staunch about things. And actually, I'm probably like one of the worst people to like try and love because I don't really accept it that well. I think lots of people are like that, actually.
Yeah. So tell me then, if you are that person, if you think you are that person at the very least, then what was it about your partner that made him sort of, I guess, you know, come to you and want to stick through that and kind of go get to this place that you're at now?
I don't know. I don't know whether he thought... to be honest,
he's on the podcast next week.
Yeah.
We'll get his response then.
I think he wasn't spectacular at loving either.
Right.
I don't think he'd ever been in love, really. Although I'm sure all his ex-girlfriends are now screaming, no, please. But
just for the record too, if you're an ex-girlfriend of his and you hate listening to this podcast, because I assume that's the only reason you've tuned in, please tune out now.
Yeah. I think that something happened in our lives that made us have to think about love really very carefully. And I think it was the finding of Tim's... antidepressants that kind of unraveled this massive secret that he'd been keeping from himself and kind of his whole everybody in his life for such a long time, that suddenly his secret was out, that he was, you know, he was living with clinical depression and no one had known, and my secret was out, that perhaps what I was looking for was someone to look after, and I'd never admitted to myself that that's what I wanted, and that could also be love, and that could be part of a relationship. And I think any time I ever wanted to be nice to somebody, or if I ever felt like I wanted to be good to somebody, I thought for some reason that would be a stupid thing to do. We both realized at the same time, maybe.
That's a really, okay, so for a start, that's a really good area, because I think that's an observation that a lot of people, sometimes the thing that you want to do is be able to help someone else or give to somebody else or, you know, be there to support somebody else.
Yeah, I know. And I don't know why I thought that that was a negative thing, because, of course, I don't spend my day being his mother, but I do spend my time thinking about him all the time. And of course, it only really works if that person respects the fact that you're thinking of them all the time and probably is also doing exactly the same for you, which he does for me. But yeah, it's funny. It's funny what your version of love is until you kind of grow up enough to find out that it wasn't what you thought it was, maybe.
It's how much of it do you think that we get from? You said that you came from a family where the parents weren't together.
Yeah.
So I've always, because my parents have been together for 43 years, right?
Whoa.
And, you know, still I would say, yeah, very much in love. And, you know, not necessarily a demonstrably loving couple, but like a very much you are 100% sure that, you know, they're in it together. And, you know, I never had a thought that they were ever going to split up or not be together, you know, through good and bad. And there was definitely some, you know, some bad times. Like, you always kind of felt that. So I just grew up thinking that's what life was, you know. But you find that people who didn't come from that have a completely different perspective on that. How much of that do you think comes from your parents? How much comes from the media's representations of what love are, you know, from your friends? Like, is it, who was important, or where do you think your opinions on those things came from beforehand?
I definitely think they come from your parents. Because there's so much learning that happens before you really even conscious that you're learning. Do you know what I mean? And I think that sort of early years development from like one onwards is like so instrumental to who you are as a person. I do think you do learn behavior from film, or, you know, and I can definitely, you know, I've imitated things through films and through media and through friends, but I think it is your parents. And I think my grandparents were together, but he was such a shit to her all the time, and she just took it. And my mum had her heart broken, which she won't mind me saying, like so badly by my father, that all men meant was, all that the man was a heartbreaker. So as soon as you're taught that, I guess, that's so instrumental in how you view the world. We didn't have any men in our family, really. So we're all women. We're all really powerful and strong. We don't, you know, like we're all totally capable of existing alone. So you kind of have in your mind, like, why would I need a man?
Right.
So then it's like having to relearn. And I think that's what my 20s were spent doing, relearning. Like, I went out with some such strange people and it was like, oh, I'm trying on this archetype of a man and I'm trying on this archetype. Yeah, it was very strange. So I think it took me a long time to understand equal partnership, you know, that I could share. Like, I'm terrible at sharing. Tim now is like, you're so selfish. Like, you know, everything is for you. Isn't that how life is? And he's like, no. We share. It's like, I don't want to share, you know? But yeah, kind of getting it now.
Also, there's got to be, like, I guess, a positive to that as well. The fact that you felt so self-determined, the fact that you grew up thinking, I can just do it myself, that you didn't have those boundaries or restrictions on what you thought was possible to do.
Exactly. I think I'm pregnant, right? I'm 5 months pregnant, even though I don't look. I know I do.
You don't, actually.
I got my belly poking out a bit, but... maybe it looked like I had too much beer when I was in Adelaide.
No, you look like you're pregnant. But yeah. You don't look 5 months pregnant.
Yeah, nearly 5 months. So
you look like you are at that pregnant stage where if you didn't know someone was pregnant, I did know that you were pregnant.
Yeah.
But if you didn't know someone was pregnant, you wouldn't mention it. You'd be at that stage of going, I'm not sure if I'm about to say the most awful thing.
She might have just had a baby. Yeah. Or she might just be a bit tubby. Yeah.
Which is fine, you know. But yourself.
Yeah, of course. So I think, yeah, so because I'm pregnant and because I'm in a relationship that I find very stable and very happy about, and that seems great, but the concept of bringing up a child in a two-parent family, if it's, you know, it just seems very, it's like completely alien to me. How's it going to work? Like, because my mum just taught us everything and she was so capable that, yeah, the positive of being brought up by a single woman who is like, just does everything and doesn't even like, she's not even like saying like, I'm superwoman, I'm super feminist, I'm doing everything. She's just doing it by demonstrating and doing that. You become very capable, but I'm like panicking. Like if I have a little girl, I want her to be like that. So then how do you make, I guess it's just making sure that I demonstrate to her that women, and you know, are very important to me, that women can do everything that a man can do, and that's like what all of my work centers around anyway, you know. Yeah. What I mean, as much as it's not always like this is a feminist show, it is super feminist,
right? Well, because you think that I'm people a woman should be able to treat it equally.
Yeah, exactly.
You know how that's feminist at the moment still.
Yeah,
it really shouldn't be. We should get to a point where
I know.
There's so many interesting things that have already been brought up that I want to explore. So we'll pick through them one by one and we'll get to each and every one of them. So I want to get back to your parenting philosophy, but we'll save that for a bit because I want to talk about the idea of, you know, the fact that you and Tim did a show together. And I think that's because he run me through what happened there. You mentioned earlier that you found the discovery of the antidepressants. Yeah. But tell me, because he's not a performer, right?
Not
or
at
wasn't
all.
A performer beforehand.
No, he works in advertising, account director of like a big buying agency. So he'd spend his days like buying advertising space and going for lunches. Like his life was like lunches all the time. That's all I ever saw him do,
right.
Having lunch with people. No, he, how it worked was 6 months we were together. He moved in after about a month. It was like really quick.
Any fear about that going so quickly?
Was it
one of those things where you just felt it straight
away? As soon as I met him, because we met on a one night stand, you know, like, and it was like, we were both battered. So it wasn't clear that it was going to be anything. But the next day, there was a part of me that I was like, oh my God, this guy.
Right.
Which was really lucky because it was basically just like, you'll do. And he was the same with me, you know.
Yeah.
Both of us were on the pull. It was like, that'll do. So the next day.
The new romantic comedy from Bryony Kimmy. <No,
it's laughs>
That'll do.
It's so funny, but it was that, and we both admit that. I mean, he says that he was like, you know, saw me across the room. I was so drunk, I couldn't even see. So, the next day, though, it was like something magical started to happen, and it was very, very quick. 6 months into the relationship, he was living with me. I found these tablets in his backpack. So Citalopram, which I recognise the name of from having a friend with also with mental health problems, he thought I would instantly leave. You know, he had it in his head that this was a total weakness and something that was like completely unappealing. And I was like, there was no way I would leave for that reason. Like, I know loads of people on antidepressants, but he perhaps didn't, you know.
Was it, do you think, is that a gender difference? Do you think, is it more intimate for, like, is it more of an admission for a man to say that, you know, he's struggling or needs some help than it is for a woman? Or is it, do you
unfortunately,
think across the board?
I think, unfortunately, although I see gender as a spectrum, I think in terms of, like, the built idea of what a man is, especially our generation or, you know, older, is that men don't talk about their feelings, that having emotions is... Not having emotions, but crying is certainly weak. And then if you have a disease that actually one of the symptoms is water leaking from eyes, then, right, you know, you're a bit screwed. So he was like, adamant that I was going to leave. And I was like, I just was annoyed because he hadn't told me, really.
Right.
But, you know, I understood after he explained why he hadn't told me that he hadn't told anybody. So... Of course, I didn't instantly think, let's make a show.
Right.
Although my brain probably did go, show.
Well, you're a performer. Every yeah. time something happens, you're like, could that
yeah.
be a show?
I make stuff about my life. So, like, I guess I'm always thinking that's interesting, or at least that could be a subject of a show. 6 months of sort of process of kind of coming out, I guess, to friends and family for him, us becoming, like, total experts in the disease. It was like, we need to become really smart about this. You know, he wanted to come off his tablets. He had been on them for 8 years. He'd never tried really to come off them.
Because it would be terrifying to have to try to do that by yourself.
I think a couple of times he'd just gone cold turkey, which yeah. is like the worst thing you can do. Yeah.
Because not only do you, when you go cold turkey off those sort of medications, not only do the original problems come back, but you get everything else like
exactly.
amplified because
exactly.
you're coming off the medication.
Yeah. And also he was partying. So like he was like, you know, so... we came off the tablets and I still hadn't decided to make a show, really. It was 6 months later after that he came off the tablets. He had a really big breakdown and I was actually in Melbourne for the comedy festival and he was at home. And I came back from that to find that he'd had lied and kind of hidden the fact that he'd had a breakdown, which he was doing to protect me, to protect himself, all of those right. things. You know, again, it wasn't like, what are you doing? But it was more like, oh, man. And I just said, I'm not going away again. Like, I've come to the stage with performing that I'm less and less bothered about being away or being on stage. I find that not conducive with my lifestyle that I want. So I was already like, I can't do this. But I had worked really hard to be able to be invited to places, you know, across the other side of the globe. So he was like, don't be stupid. And I said, well, you're coming with me next time. And he was like, well, we can't afford that. And I was like, we'll have to teach you how to be a technician. And then he was like, no, that'd be rubbish. And then, no offense, technicians. And then I was like, let's make a show. And he was like, what? And I was like, yeah, let's make a show. And what would it be about? Like, what's your expertise? And he was like, well, it's either advertising or mental health. So I was like, mental health.
Yeah.
And it was a joke for a while. It was called The Way You Make Me Feel at the beginning because it was based on our favourite Michael Jackson song because right. we were like really into Michael Jackson and we were like, there's going to be Michael Jackson in it and there'll be like snogging in it. Like it was like all the things that would be in a show that we made. And in the car, yeah. we used to joke around and sing songs and stuff. And then I was like, let's actually do it. He hated his job. Like it was so bad for him mental health wise. You know, it's like the worst. Going to a job you hate, selling your soul to Barclaycard.
Yeah, how much of that, because I mean, we can stop down on each step of this, but yeah. how much of that idea of being happy through what you do, making you happy in the rest of your life, is that a thing that you think is very important?
It's difficult because I think that depression, clinical depression, is an illness.
It's a disease that you can get regardless of.
Yeah.
You can have the best. This is the thing
life.
That people don't understand.
Yeah.
You can externally have the best life to everybody else, but you've got a disease.
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't think it has anything to do with that part of it, but I think in terms of well-being and how you can manage clinical depression in terms of like. You can make it better or worse for yourself in a way, kind of the periphery of it.
To get away from the depression a little, I guess more broadly what I was asking there was,
sorry,
for you or for me or for anyone who's listening,
how
much do you value that idea of,
so much.
You know, find something you love and that will, you know, yeah, and
set
do
you
that.
Free.
And that will kind of set you free a little.
Well, we're going through that a bit at the moment because Tim's not found something he loves. You know, he's left his job and he really enjoys performing, but he's not like suddenly found this dream job. And he's like, I'm never going to find the thing I love. And some people I know have never. So I
Well, I would say possibly, and that's why I ask you this question. Because yeah. sometimes when I say it to people, I'm very lucky that I have done the thing that I wanted to do for all my life. Yeah. But I understand that most of the people who come to my shows probably aren't doing that thing.
No.
And so it sometimes feels like it's easy to say, find the thing you love and you'll never work a day in your life. But most people probably don't get that luxury.
I think it's very important to love what you do. I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because it doesn't always work, like you're saying, it doesn't always work out like that. But I think for me, I think it's very important. It's very important to my well-being to be in control of my own life, not answering to a manager or a boss. Like, being creative is very important for me. And I can see in Tim, the year that we've spent together, that those things have also liberated him in ways, you know, made him a happier person. Not to do with his depression, but just as a happier person. That we can get up in the morning what time we like some days, you know. We're lucky.
It's interesting that you appreciate that's lucky. Because sometimes I say to, you know, performers all love to moan as well to each other. And sometimes I'll be like, I was talking to my brother-in-law at Christmas. Lovely guy, my brother-in-law. We were just chatting generally. And I was talking about some movie that I'd seen last week. And he hadn't seen that movie. But, you know, he's got four kids with my sister. And, you know, he's got a job and he's busy. And I said, well, what was your favorite movie last year? And he goes, we didn't actually see an adult movie last year. Like, they went and saw some kids' films, but he didn't see one adult movie at the movies in a year. And I was like, I saw four last week.
Oh my God, yeah. I know, we are lucky.
Right.
And we do have exciting, I mean, I have an exciting life. Like, but then I think also I crave for like a very boring life, you know.
So work-life balance was something that you already have hinted at a little bit.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk to you about that. What is your perspective on that? Because I think as a performer, particularly when things start to go well and people are like, we'd love you to come to this festival, we'd love you to travel here and do this, how do you then go, but I'm also very interested in the fact that I'm in this relationship now and we're building a life together and, you know, devoting enough time to those things. Do you consciously think about that? Are you instinctive about that? No, what are your thoughts?
Everything about my life is meticulously planned.
Okay, interesting.
I think, and probably I'm not very free in my life really at all, because I really like being in control.
And where does that come from?
I don't know. I think I've just always been like that. I think I don't like not knowing what's happening a lot. Like, we have a friend staying with us from Peru at the moment, and I'm like freaking out that she doesn't know how to get to Soho Theatre today because she's meeting us to come and see your show. And it's like almost like obsessive, and she's like, I'll be fine. And I'm like, it freaks me out. So I think it's just, I don't know where it comes from. Probably some kind of like psychological trauma in my childhood.
Right.
But yeah, I plan everything. I know what I'm going to be doing in 2018. You know, like I know, I want to know. And I also find it that when I set my sights that far away, I can dream really big, and I can be like, I have to achieve the following things to get to that thing. So, and I very much always want to be going to a new place in my career. So that's one side of me, like super organized, like really trying to get, like trying to be good, trying to make sure that my art's really good, trying to make sure that my audiences grow, all of that stuff. And then on the other side, creeping slowly in over the past few years, has been like, buy a house, settle down, have a baby, like, just give it all up. That would be a really great thing to do, you know? And it's weird. I have no control over it. It's one thing in my life that I don't have control of is this, I guess, hormonal, like, change that's happened in me in my 30s. I'm trying to phase out touring. I'm trying my best to become a writer, to write shows with other people in, and figuring out at the moment how you can have an identity that's really clear, and you can be like, that's so Bryony Kimmings at work, but she's not even slightly in it, you know. And that, I think, as well as like having made five shows that are all like, hi, my name's Bryony and I did this thing, and then this is a show about what happened, you know, which is after a while you're like, yeah, it's kind of boring. I know how to make that show. The next one I make will be really great because I know how to make that show. But then people are coming up behind you making the same show and you're like, I need to make something new. So at the moment I'm writing a musical.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I like that idea of you thinking, how do I evolve my own work? Because that's because I, like you said, you're talking about different things in each show, but you get to the point where you can go, okay, well, this is how I can construct these things into a narrative that works. So how do you decide to... Because like some people would go, well, if you're onto a good thing that people love, change the topics and keep writing these great shows and, you know, build your audience. What makes you think, no, I need to step away a bit, I need to do something different? Is that that you fear that your audience will get bored with what you're doing, or is it just generally that you need to do something different inside you? Or a combination of the both, or
that,
other things?
Yeah, I think that it's to do with the fact that you see people and that they're doing the same thing over and over again, and you're like, I think to myself, you've done it, I've seen it. Like, I'm very critical as an audience. I'm like, I saw you do this last year. You know, I'm not interested in seeing the same thing again. I'm always interested in innovation in anything, you know, like a new film, in anything, I like to see something as a challenge, or maybe as like, how can we mess around with this?
It's okay. That's fine.
Come in.
Checks.
That's all right. No problem. It's okay. I said that people would come in during it, and it's totally fine.
He checks the water, don't you?
I do, yeah.
Why, though?
Why is that?
Well, this is Legionella. I also check fire extinguishers and that the toilet's clean.
What's Legionella?
Legionella. Well, that's to make sure you don't get like some terrible disease, right?
Bacterial infection.
Yeah, bacterial infection.
Oh, my God, this is amazing.
Yeah. So, well, that's good.
It's lungs, and it lives in shower heads. It's generally disgusting and horrible.
Right. Oh. So there you go. So the good news about the Soho Theatre is they check for hideous
diseases.
They haven't
got Legionella. Nice. You can take that back. Yeah. They don't have Legionella.
It's good to have a little safety.
If anyone dares to say that they do, we know that's not true.
Exactly.
What were you talking about? Oh, he writes it on the list.
Okay, here's what I want to ask you, because I've got a bunch of things. But I want to ask about, let's go back to high school. Let's say high school, when you are starting to think about what you want to do when you finish school. Are you a good student? Are you a person who's like was enjoying school? Did you think that you would study more? Did you have a clear idea of what it was that you wanted to do going forward? Like, take me back to you at sort of like 16, 17, something like that.
Oh, God. I was horrible. I probably wasn't that horrible. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I definitely didn't go like, I want to be a performance artist. I didn't even know what performance art was. I was from quite a small town, quite towny. I don't know what it's like in Australia, but I don't know. My mum's not like academic, so it was like, was never like, you should go to university. That wasn't, I kind of understood what that was, but it wasn't really what we did in our family. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I wanted to smoke weed and wear short skirts. You know, I didn't,
right.
You know, that's all. And I was naughty at school. I'm very, very bright, actually. I didn't. That's taken me a really long time to say, okay, I'm actually quite bright, but I'm not academic.
Right.
Not in a kind of traditional sense. And I think that's less to do with, like, knowledge and more to do with authority.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I had a massive problem with authority in school, and I definitely can remember being, you know, kicked out of a lot of lessons and... But I also,
it's a theme that comes up a lot when I talk to artists in particular on this podcast, which is that suspicion of unearned authority.
Yeah.
Is that just something that's instinctive to you, you think? Like, just that certain people that, you know, when you see someone up the front and you're like, I just feel like you're full of shit and I can't engage in this?
Yeah, I don't know. But I guess my mum and I never had that relationship where she was like, I am the matriarch and you're going to do what I say. We had a very, like, it was negotiating. And it was, I can remember saying to my mum, like, everybody goes out at night and I like, they sneak out of their house at like 12 midnight. They all go and smoke weed down the park. And I really don't want to go because I don't want you to get up in the night and to worry where I am. And she was like, okay, thanks for telling me that tonight you can go, you know?
Yeah.
So it was like, and everyone was like, your mom's so cool. And it's like, right. No, it's just a negotiation between two human beings. And so I think as soon as someone's like, you can't do that. And I'm like, why? And they're like, because that's not in the rules. And I'm like, what rules, you know?
Yeah.
So it was like, I remember German just being like, the German class, because we always had German, just being like so adamant that she was right about something. And I just, makes my blood boil when it's like, she was wrong, I think. So I spat my chewing gum in her face, you know. So it's not like...
And a performance artist was born.
I think there was a couple of teachers that I really got on with,
Was there someone who inspired you? Was there somebody who had time for you? Was there something that you took from school that you still have with you?
There was definitely a teacher, and it was a theatre teacher that didn't take my shit right? So I'd never do my homework. I'd never, never do anything. And then she really bollocked me one day, and she didn't just like really tell me off. She cussed me out, like, and got it right. She was like, "You're a scared little girl who doesn't know if she's ever going to be able to leave her council estate." You know, she really like was really, and I was like, I started crying.
Right.
And I was like, she knows all of my fears, you know. But I loved her after that, and I was like, she's totally correct. And of course, like at that age, you don't know why you're railing or rallying against authority, or you know, or what you're terrified of. But she hit the nail on the head, and for some reason, it was like I just loved her. And another teacher as well who taught law, who I was really, you know, we had law for some reason, and I was really good at it. And she was the only person that was like, she didn't know me because she was new to the school.
Right.
And she didn't know my sister. So I guess she was like, oh, this student's actually quite good. And probably all the teachers in the staff room were like, are you mental? And well, she was like, you should study law.
Yeah. To bring to the table.
Yeah.
Right?
So I didn't know what I wanted to do. I finished my A-levels with really bad results. I'd stayed on at sixth form just because the guy that sold weed that I knew was staying. You know, like it wasn't, there was all my decisions that are life decisions were never like it would be academically good. It was like, well, this seems like a great, you know, it was right. 2 more years of school.
Plus, I like how much weeds come up. Normally, I'm the one in the podcast who's like blaming all my decisions on weed. It's good to have somebody else.
It was such a boring place where I grew up. You know, there really wasn't anything to do. I mean, there was a lot of heroin in that area. And luckily,
did you not get sucked into that sort of
thing? I'm not stupid. Yeah. I think, you know, and that's awful because I don't think all addicts are idiots.
Oh,
but
no, of course
like
not.
In terms of like being 15 and doing it, that's like reckless and kind of nuts. And I'm, you know, I think because I had a really good mum, it was like there was no way I'd do that. And I think I always knew that I'd get out of the godforsaken town, but I didn't know how, and kind of couldn't really be bothered because probably too stoned. Went and worked in a shop for a year and was like, I cannot do this.
So what sort of shop did you work in?
H&M.
Oh, okay. So like a real mainstream sort of, like, you know. Okay, so what job were you doing at H&M?
Just stacking, like, you know, doing the rails and working the people coming in, trying stuff on, doing the tills.
So tell me this. How important do you think it is? Because this is a little pet theory of mine. And of course, with all pet theories, they're not 100% right? But I kind of feel like the more successful artists have it had at least one terrible, terrible job that they know that they never want to go back to. I'm a bit sus of people who've never had a real terrible job and are doing art because I'm like, just do something terrible so you understand what normal life is like.
It's funny, isn't it? I think you're right. I don't know, because it's really mean to say like just because you were privileged and just because you've had money that somehow makes your opinion or your life experience not valid, right? But, you know, I'm also a working class person that's like total staunch labour and like really hates the Tories, so like of course I think that hard graft equals amazing comedy and like life experience, but like I didn't just work
but
at H&M. Like,
I mean, it's hard for some really rich comedian to come out and be like, you know, so my driver took the wrong way this morning, and what's the deal with that?
What's that with drivers,
guys? What's with caviar being so expensive these days?
You don't really get that many like you get loads of middle class, but probably toffs. I think it's true. I mean, I think less. I don't write stand up that often, so I don't think it's like solid like material. But like, I do think I've worked the shittest jobs in my I used to work in a bookies. Like, it got held up with people with guns.
Oh, really?
Like, I used to clean toilets in a kid's school, which was like the grossest. Like, imagine children, like tiny children's toilets. I've worked since I was like 14. Uh-huh. I worked in a chip shop for quite a long time. I mean, you know, my mum's a cleaner and she's irons. Like, we're a working family.
Yeah.
And I've always had to work for money, and so all of those things, I think, maybe they didn't give me like armor for like, or like material, but they made me never want to do those things again.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I think that's important.
Yeah.
I really do feel like, you know, sometimes, I mean, particularly, and I only speak from the perspective of performers just because it's what I see more often, but I do sometimes look at the people who went straight from high school to stand up or, you know, to performing and think, just do anything else first.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it is. Make it the most terrible thing in the world. But just know that there are terrible things out there.
Yeah.
Okay. So you finish high school, what happens?
So I do this job for a year. I'm like, this, I can't do this forever. I can't live here forever. Everyone else has left. I decide I have to go back and study. And I go and do a night course of history. It was history, English literature, and media studies. I had to get A-levels to get to university. And I knew I wanted to go to university then because everyone had gone. It was really fun. I kept visiting them.
Yeah.
And the woman that had, the law teacher at the school that I'd gone to, had been kept in contact with me because she worked at this night college that I was at. And she was like, you should do law, but I didn't have the grades. So I was like, is there anything? Like, she was like, but you can do this thing called a law conversion course in the UK where you can do any degree and then you go and do a study for 2 years and it turns your degree into a law degree and then you can become a barrister. Uh-huh. So I just thought, I really want to buy my mum's flat for her house, and it'd be so cool to be a barrister. So I thought, what can I study that's really easy? And I was like, I'll study theatre and art. Yeah, that's what happened. And then I loved it. Yeah. And I got sidetracked and I never did buy my mum's flat. But I still hope, like, I still hope one day I'll be able to, off the performance art salary that I get.
Oh, that will be a great moment. If you can buy your mum's flat on a performance art, that's a good moment. So you fall in love with it. Why? And why particularly performance art? Of all the you know, things that you can study when it comes to theatre, like, what was it about, you know, performance art that particularly, was there someone or something or some facet of it that particularly resonated with you?
So when I got there, the course wasn't really theatre and it wasn't really art. It was like, it was performance art. And so it was a study of like performance artists from like Dadaists in like the 30s or whenever that was, all the way through to like the present day. And so it was like, there was no text. We didn't study any text, like no Shakespeare.
Okay.
We didn't learn how to act, although that is what it said in the prospectus. It was this really left field kind of strange course taught by like hippies, basically. And
yeah,
I just got really into the artists, really, that I just never heard of anything like that before. It was so exciting, like Frank O.B., like making a protest about the fact that he couldn't give blood because he was gay and he would bleed all over canvases in the Turbine Hall of the Tate and put them up and display them or make clothes out of them. And then Marina Abramovich, like putting all of her loads of objects in a room with her in a gallery, including a loaded gun and all of this stuff, and then saying to the audience, do what you want to me for 12 hours. You know, it was like at the extreme of what human beings were allowing their experience to be. Now, of course, some people will think that sounds crap, or like that sounds like self-obsessed or whatever. I just found it fascinating.
Yep.
And I just found it really like communicating in that way very exciting, and I just met really lovely people that I was just like, who were also really fascinated by it. And then I realized I was a nerd, that I was like really obsessed with like this thing, and that I was really wanting to know all about it. And I'd never felt like that before. I never cared. I was like, I'll just study them how much I need to study and smoke the weed, and so I found the thing I loved, I guess. And it's so weird because my mum was like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm cutting myself, like I'm bleeding. But I think at least I felt like I had in some way, I mean, people don't accept me that much into the live art world, that, and it's a kind of strange thing because I'm very poppy, you know, I'm kind of, my work's quite pink and often quite like music. And
okay, so that's interesting to me.
Yeah.
Because I consider you to be, because I'm a very much I'm a stand-up, like, and that's really what I am. In fact, I would, like, you know, even say that when it comes to stand-up comedy, you know, my philosophy was always, I knew I was never going to be, you know, as brilliant or provocative as a Bill Hicks or a George Carlin or whatever. But what I wanted to do was kind of something that would be mainstream popular, but not shit. Like, I thought you could be both. I thought you could be, like, you know, like popular, but also do something that was worth at least listening to and like talk about interesting topics in kind of a mainstream way. So when I see what you do, like, I always see you as being so like wonderfully provocative or interesting or like edgy. But I guess maybe because from the performance art world, are you seen as being a bit more mainstream does that work?
Yeah, I think so.
Right.
I'm called the Princess of Performance Art.
Right.
Which is weird. That's what someone called me in the
So you're like the mainstream
paper.
Crossover.
I'm like the Kylie
you?
Of
Are you the Kylie?
Yeah. I think Exeunt magazine called me the Kylie of Performance Art. Which is weird because I don't know, like,
I would have thought Kylie's the Kylie of Performance
Art. Yeah, exactly. Just let Kylie alone. Let her be the princess of everything. Maybe it's my own insecurity or my own kind of like self-doubt, but I don't get involved. I don't do much gallery work. Uh-huh. I don't get invited to major art festivals. But then performance artists are often on the periphery of that. It's often more sculpture or kind of video art. More and more performance art kind of has its heyday every now and then. So I can't remember why I was saying that I didn't feel like I was a really kind of that experimental.
Well, I wanted to, while we were talking about this, because the thing that was interesting was like, how much are other people's opinions of what you do important to you?
Yeah.
Which voices do you listen to?
Yeah.
Which ones do you try to ignore? How do you take feedback into your work?
Yeah. Well, I'm quite secretive when it comes to making work. I don't make work like a stand-up would. I don't trial stuff in a public way. I make stuff in my own studio, and then I have a very carefully selected invited audience I invite, and I share probably at the end of every week that I'm making something, and I might make for like 8 weeks. And they're people that are either my dramaturg or my kind of, or people that I tend to get to help me write stuff. And then there'll also be like friends, and then there'll also be an opportunity for each of those people to bring someone that's never seen my work before. And there always has to be a good percentage of people that haven't seen me, but also that aren't artists or in the art industry. And then I do a very specific form. So I show the work. I've already planned and schemed exactly how I want them to make the audience feel. Very mathematical about how I make work. And then they fill in a form and they let me know if the work is working.
Oh.
And then I go back into the studio, back to the drawing board.
And so you really will take that feedback.
Yeah.
You're on board?
But the questions are very specific.
An example of like, say, a question you would ask, just to give us an example.
What did you see?
Oh, okay.
So it's like, I know what I'm doing, or I think I know what I'm doing, but if I think I'm this wonderful, majestic woman riding in on a horse, and then someone says, some stupid bitch flumped in on a fake horse, like a dick, then I know that it's not majestic and amazing and like how I imagined it in my head, you know? So I check what my imaginary idea of what I look like and what's going on is against.
That's really interesting to me, because I so often think that's the hardest thing, and stand-ups, I think, get this wrong all the time, myself included, where you know what the story is about in your head. So sometimes you skip an important bit because you don't need it. You get it, but you haven't told the audience the bit that they really need to understand to respond to the story.
So it's sort of checking. I mean, I make work quite mathematically. I know I always make sure that my work is concerned with one question, like, why is the world trying to sexualize and commodify my 9-year-old niece, was like my last big show that I made.
So you really do just start with a
question.
One question.
About the world.
It's very interesting. And then the rest of the show is an exploration of that idea, really.
Yeah, it is. And it might be abstract, or it might be like completely lecture-based format. The form is always determined by the subject matter. I don't let the form be determined by my ego. So like, if it's going to be an audio piece that can only be downloaded, that's what that subject matter needs. If it's a one-to-one performance that will last only one performance, you know, one day at a festival, that's what that subject needs. So for me, it was never about being a theatre maker, comedian. It was like, I'm interested in this topic. I get really nerdy about something. I get really obsessed with it. And then I think, okay, like, for example, somebody asked me to make a work about cancer. And I said the only time I'd ever want to make a show about cancer is if it's a musical. There, that's the decision. It has to be a musical because they're so vast, joyous. They are concerned with huge subjects, but they also have space for humor. Uh-huh. If you asked me to write a one-woman show about cancer, I would never make it. It would be shit.
Right.
It would be like, let me tell you my cancer story, you know, which is like the worst show ever.
Right.
So, yeah.
But Cancer the Musical. I mean, that's...
Well, exactly.
That's
Yeah. I'm trying my best to, like, not make it like Anna Nicole the Opera or kind of Jerry Springer the Musical, because, like, this kind of, like, ironic choice of, like, form to do with subject matter, but more to do with, like, Sondheim when he's, like, he deals with racism or he deals with, like, pure poverty, but it's, like, so epic and joyful, you know?
It's interesting to me, the idea of trying to convey like a complex idea and then let the form you know, the method of delivery kind of, you know, take care of itself.
Yeah.
There must be sometimes a temptation or pressure externally for then, if something's been successful, to then turn it into another format though, right?
Yeah.
To write a book or to turn it into a show or a DVD or a blah, blah, blah. How do you deal with those sort of things?
I do select the wraparound activity at the beginning as well, so I'm quite organised.
You are, really are.
It's because I'm also teaching this week, so I'm teaching artists, so it's like I'm sort of in that mindset. So like I might know that, like, for example, the show Credible, Likeable Superstar Role Model, it's a theatre show with my niece, she's nine. Mm-hmm. It's kind of set in a fantasy land and it's about the world trying to sexualise and commodify children. But it's also the play version of that because it felt like it was okay to make a play. And then in order to make the show, I asked my niece to invent a pop star and I promised her that I would become that pop star and that I'd make her world famous. So there was a whole social campaign that happened before. You know, 22 million people accessed that pop star. And so it had like a shelf life that had, that pop star had music, a website, had gigs. I played main stage at Bestival with that pop star, you know, so like, it's like, and in a way there was the download available of the iTunes of the music. Mm. So I always select like what the wraparound activity is. And often like it can also be that art happens in press. That happens a lot for me. Like the press campaign is as important to the creation of the work and the viewing of the work as the theatre show at the end. So I select how an audience will access the work at the beginning.
No, I think I find this absolutely fantastic. And
How
do you get a sense of, do you have a sense of who your audience is when you're thinking about these things? Or are you just thinking purely about the work and then going, well, then hopefully it will access a certain audience? Do you have a clear idea in your mind of, you know, that this is perhaps who this will respond to or who I'm trying to get it out to or who I'm trying to engage it?
Yeah, I do. Obviously, I want my work to be really accessible. I pick really accessible themes. Like, that's what I mean about, so I was talking about earlier, actually, about like the performance art world, like really not being that welcoming, because I don't try and abstract things. I don't make things difficult. I make things really easy. Big concepts, but really accessible. Yeah, big questions, but really accessible. And I really would hope that my nan would come and see it and still take something from it. But like, for example, the show with Tim, the idea is that it's men that come and see that show, and not just men that like art, but men that work in advertising. So like there's a massive campaign around us getting like groups of men from advertising companies to come and see the show, as well as all the old theatre bobs that will always come. Right. But that work was made for men that might have mental health problems and didn't want to talk about it. So often the audience, I mean, it's normally the theatre audience, I know that they're going to come, and then there might be like an extra kind of like add on, like, I think this is much more for older people, this show, or, you know, I think this would be really good for children. Like, I make work for children as well.
When you talk about the process of like putting something together, and you said that you're teaching, you know, this week.
Yeah.
How do you think about, and I imagine you have thought about it, seeing that, you know, you think about everything quite meticulously. How have you thought about how you pass on knowledge to other people? Like, how have you thought about, you know, as a teacher, what do I tell people? What do I say to people? Because I assume you don't want to be prescriptive too much in, but is there certain rules or things that you really want to pass on to other people?
I've really tried my best to kind of come up with a theory, right? Not a theory that's only specific to me making work, but a theory that I can pass on, right? And so I teach week-long workshops and I write a lot, and I'm trying to write a book in the end probably about how I make work and the things that I find really helpful and things that I find really destructive. Because I think that a lot of artists, every artist I come into contact with on my workshops and just artists in general, are like riddled with self-doubt, absolutely paralyzed by procrastination often, really find it really difficult to find starting points, can't work alone in a room, you know, like there's all these classic things. And actually I find making art really easy, and it's not because I'm really good at it, but I find it's just because I've devised these techniques to keep myself from self-doubting. Like I have this thing where everybody in my workshop all week does a thing called a blitz, where they can't stop dancing, and when they stop they have to write something, and when we start again they can't write anymore, and then we stop and they write, because it's like almost like you have to get out of your own head all the time. Uh-huh. So most of the workshop we're just dancing to like MC Hammer, and then like every now and then, you know, like I'm like, right, and that's what I do when I'm on my own. So and a couple of people have asked me this week for the first time ever, because I think they're more established artists and often I'll work with, like, why are you handing all of this information to us? This is exactly how you make work. Like, don't you mind that we're going to use it? And I'm like, no, of course not, because you're never going to do it like I'll do it, you know. You'll never, it's like generating material. It's not my material, you know. So, yeah, I think it's very important to dispel that kind of myth that it's really hard to make art, because it's sort of what you're told at university as well. And it's like, hang on, why isn't anyone telling people like it's really joyous and beautiful?
Like I think that we do often make that mistake, all of us.
Yeah.
You know, that it's just, sometimes it's just fun to make something or just to like start or to not like worry that it's got to be great at the start, to just like make at the start.
Or to make loads of shit stuff on purpose, you know, and be like, let's write the shittest version of the show.
Right.
Right at the beginning, you know, like one of the things I ask is like, write the shit show that you're going to make out of this subject matter.
Okay.
Now write the good show, you know.
That's a really good way of approaching it too.
Why not? All right. Sometimes it can be good.
So there's so many things I want to talk about, but we're running a little bit out of time because I've got a show in a little bit. So we need to get through a couple of these things. I want to ask you about, so you're going to be a parent. Have you thought about how you're going to parent? Have you and Tim talked about like certain, you know, the way you guys are gonna, you know, approach it and you know, whether you have any specific philosophies or whatever, what you want to?
Yeah, I think we're very similar, he and I, very practical and quite logical, not super emotional as people, probably robots, robot parents. I think we've decided that we don't want to do that kind of like when it's a baby, like it sleeps in our bed, it kind of demand fed feeding and all that like kind of hippie stuff. And my mum's really disappointed, I think, because she's like really, you know, she was like really like hippie-fied. She used to live in Adelaide and she was like, you know, the boob was just out all the time. We want to have structure and kind of like, you know, it's going to be like, this is the bedtime and you're just going to do that. And which probably won't work at all.
I also love, though, that the strictest parent on the block is going to be the performance artist. I know. It's so counterintuitive, but I love everything about it.
But I think
you get away with everything. It's because your mum isn't a performance artist. She's so picky about everything.
Yeah, she's so organised. I think I got really used to having a child around when I was on tour with Taylor. So I was on tour with her for nearly like 2 years. So I got really used to having a child, you know, I guess.
Right.
And she was such a good kid, but I really enjoyed having the time to be like, you see that, this is what that is. And it's like that because, you know, because of the government or, you know, and really like having these like really kind of in-depth talks with her. And she was like 9 and she's like from a family where there's like 7 of them, nearly 6 of them. There's another one probably coming soon, I'm sure. But they don't have time to have these conversations. And so I always really loved, she wasn't even that interested, but I really loved imparting knowledge onto her and kind of like, and you know, part of the project that we did was like, I want her to be a feminist, you know, I want her to understand what that means. So I really love teaching, you know, and I love children. So, and I love fucking like messing around with them and like really having fun. So I'm childlike in myself, I guess. So I just really want them to feel really secure, but also to like totally have a wicked childhood and have so much fun. I had so much fun when I was a kid. I was like constantly in fields, like running around like an idiot and like just free. And I just want them to feel free.
Do you have an attitude to where you would like to raise children?
Yeah, I do need to be in the country. I don't. And I've had this like really strong feeling because I've got lots of mates that are from London and they grew up in London. They're always like the coolest ones. And they're like, they're so far in their career and they know everybody and they're so smart and streetwise. But I just can't deny them like the smell of like running through like a field and like climbing trees. And Tim's exactly the same. So I think we're both like, we want to bring our kid up in the countryside, but we don't want them to be a cunt, you know?
That's a pretty good attitude. That's almost a philosophy.
Like, we don't want them to be like close-minded, towny, racist, you know, all of those things that equal British town, really, which is a terrible thing to say. But it is kind of like UKIP supporters. So in a way, it's going to come in and out of London. It's going to have its gay uncles. I've got a lesbian sister. Like, you know, like I've got friends that are from all over the world. So hopefully, but then you have that. Do you ever have this feeling of like, oh no, they're going to be one of those horrible, annoying art kids? I meet people that have got like really annoying, like art kids that are at festivals like Tarquin. Look at him running around. Look at how liberal he is. I hate him, you know? I hate those kids.
Oh, I know. And I bet that's how I'm going to raise my children. I will become everything that I hate.
I know, me too, probably.
We need to finish up in a minute, but I want to ask you a couple of quick questions before the end. Do you have any feelings of what happens when you die? Do you care? Do you, now that you are going to be a parent...
Just a quick question.
We've got a little bit of time. Yeah. You don't have to answer it in 30 seconds, yeah. But it's one I like to ask people is, are you aware of death? Is it something that is conscious in your life or in your work? B, is about to be a parent, does that change it in any way?
Because I'm writing this musical about cancer and because it's in collaboration with like 7 people that have cancer, I think, and a couple of them are terminal and, you know, one of them's already died recently. I think it's just been the last year or so that I've been really thinking about death. I've never been like, I never think about death. I always know that that's the end point. I don't have a faith. So I've never thought anything other than my body returns to the earth. It feeds worms, which feeds birds, which feeds, you know, and I think of that as my philosophy, I guess, is that is what will happen.
A sort of circle of life.
Yeah, exactly.
We're all
circle
part
of life.
The Lion King. You got it from the Lion King,
yeah.
Right?
And I got it. Damn it.
And what I want to say is my philosophy is Hakuna Matata.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I don't think it's anything more than that, and I'm kind of happy with that.
Yeah.
Like, I take from the earth, I give to the earth, and that sounds really cheesy, but that's how I feel.
No, that doesn't sound cheesy at all. I think that seems like so you don't have any sense that it's bigger than that at all. There's never been a point in your life where you're like, I feel like there's more than this. Do you believe that we're probably just an accident in the corner of the universe?
Yeah, I do.
So then, with that in mind, how do you then find meaning in your life? Like, what I mean, I don't mean how do you, like a Christian person would say, how do you find meaning?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you personally, what meaning do you give your life?
Well, I kind of feel like that might give it a bit more urgency. Mm. You know, like if you know that you're going to go to heaven or you're going to go to wherever you think you're going to go to, then why bother now? You know, it's going to be great later. So I feel like if you just admit that there's not going to be, probably not going to be, you know, I'm agnostic. I'm not going to say like there's nothing.
Right.
So you can't say that.
But if you admit that you don't know.
I don't know.
But the thing that I always seem to think, and please feel free to disagree with this, but the thing that I always say when it's on this point is, of course, I believe there are things that I can't explain.
Yeah.
We can't live as a human being and love and feel and all those sort of things without thinking, you know, these are things that, but here's the thing, in our lifetimes, in the lifetime that we personally are going to, there's not going to be a solution.
No
one's going to come up with the idea of, oh no, we've nailed it.
Yeah.
It was definitely Muhammad.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
that's what I think. So therefore it's like, well, then this is the time, this is the chance. Like, I guess it's Buddhist in the way of like, we live in the now and make it good. But also don't worry if it's not, and don't be a bastard to everybody else because everybody else has just got one, you know? So I don't think anything happens, and I don't fear death, but I certainly think about it a lot more. And I think it's less to do with the baby. I don't think it's anything really to do with that yet, although that'll probably become really poignant, I reckon. Like, then it's like, shit, must be more careful, don't die. Or don't kill the baby by accident. but I think it's more to do with, you know, having not really had anyone die very close to me, and then now being very much talking about death all the time and the fear of death, and kind of the musical very much being about the fact that we don't talk about death enough, and so therefore cancer is still this really terrifying thing, and how about if we talked about death more, it wouldn't be so terrifying. That I think it's very close to me at the moment for some reason, death.
If you could change one thing about your life, is there something that you would have changed? Is there something, a mistake you made or a thing? Because I tend to believe that most of the things that make us who we are now, you know, you never know which are the influential things. Mm. So if you took out a good thing or a bad thing, it might change who you are right now. But is there a regret or a time you did something where you just were like, I just wish that one. If I had one do-over, this would be it.
No.
That's nice. That's a nice thing to think.
No, I don't think about the past that much.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So Do you find yourself not a reflective person at all about the past? Is that because you're constantly looking forward, trying to create something new?
I think it's that, and I think that actually sometimes that can be like a bit of a problem for me, is that like it's like, why don't you just think for a second why that happened? And instead it's like, well, you know, like I can't sit still, like I can't. And Tim's always like, why do you need to know? Like, and like, so like the bit we find out we're pregnant, it's like, instead of being like, yay, I'm like, I can't wait to feel it move. Then it's like, when the baby starts moving, it's like, I can't wait to push it out. You know, like, it's like, it can't even like, I didn't even get a chance to go like, wow, it moving is so amazing. It's like, done, tick. What? How's it going to feel when it comes out my vagina? Done, tick. Like, I do feel like sometimes I should slow down a little bit. And I am.
In your work, are you able to be present and in the moment, though? Like, is there... Because, I mean, what you're talking about sometimes is that... Like, I mean, that idea, if you're looking forward, how can you be, you know, present, yeah, like, yeah, right in that moment?
Probably
I imagine with your work, you must
only
have
when
right.
I'm on stage, right? Probably right. Only in that moment am I, like... That's a very... That's a very Buddhist thought, isn't it? That it's, like... When you're on stage, right, it's very difficult to be on autopilot, especially if you like if you improvise, or especially if you kind of it's new, and you've never had a more confronting situation than 200 people staring at you, going like, "Do it, do it," and you're like, "Shit!" And it's that probably the only moment where I probably stop and go, "This is the one thing I have to focus on." And that's probably why I really enjoy performing, and also like, yeah, I think it's. I really like being on stage. I can't remember what I was going to say. I really like being on stage.
All right. Look, we should finish up regardless, but I want to make sure we plug particularly some Brisbane shows, yeah, that you were doing, because this will come out. You're going to play the Brisbane Powerhouse with – now, is that the show with Tim, or are you doing a different –
Yes, it is the show with Tim, which is called Fake It Till You Make It.
And I know you're also doing some London shows of that, because I walked by a giant poster of it down by the Underbelly.
So. Did it have something written on its forehead?
It did. It said something Tories about Tories hate women.
Someone was like, someone's written something on your poster. I was like, I bet they've written cunt. And they were like, no, Tories hate women.
Tories hate women. It's
I don't know
on your
why.
Forehead.
Yeah, they've cleaned it off. I was like, called them up. I was like, take that off. That's not promotion. That's negative press. Yeah, I've got Brisbane Powerhouse in June. I think the 19th of June we were there for a week.
Well, people in Australia, you can Google it and make sure, yeah, that you find. But it's definitely it worth coming it out and seeing the show.
Yeah.
And then where does that show, what happens after
South
that?
South Bank in July, yes, and then Latitude Festival for like a festival edition, and then Edinburgh at the Traverse, and then it's on tour. It'll be on tour for like until May, I think, the following year. So May next year. So for another year.
And are you on social media or any of those places?
Yes, at Bryony Kimmings on Twitter. And my website is bryonykimmings.com. If you come and see the show in the next 6 months, I'll be heavily pregnant, which I think is a nice addition to the love story.
Well, I mean, not in the next... What are you? You're 5 months. You're not going to have 11.
Oh, yeah, no. I finish in October. I'm going to carry mine for 11. That's my new project.
That's what you play. That's your next show.
Put my hand up there.
The extra
keep my
2 months.
Legs crossed.
Just yeah, keeping it in.
Like an elephant. I'm going to gestate for as long as an elephant.
Okay, well, this has been absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for doing the podcast.
Thank you.
I'm glad that you could squeeze it in, and someone's knocking at the door. So there we go. We might as well finish on that note. We'll be right back.
Heaven knows I can't be without you.
Heaven knows I won't live without you. When two put us back together, I gotta know, will you stay forever?